You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here, on my right, we've got Bobby Osinski. Bobby.
Hey, Mike. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good, Bob. Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hey, Mike.
It was good.
Next to him, we've got Brandon Bertheim.
What's up, Mike?
And next to him, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Michael. Hello. How are we?
Wow. And next to him, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
And finally, over here on my left, we've got the one and only, it's been 6 years, Rob Arbitier.
Hello there, Mike. Hello, everybody else, too.
And guys, we are celebrating our six-year anniversary. Yay! On show 118. Woo! Ooh, 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 ooh. And as you can tell, we have many people here. Not really. But yeah, guys, we've done this for 6 years. We started way back in 2006, and we actually posted the first podcast in April, but in true Audio Nowcast form, we actually recorded it in March.
Very nice.
So yeah, it's been 6 years. And in honor of our six-year anniversary, we've got a fantastic guest. And actually, I can't do justice in introducing him, so I'm going to hand it over to Bobby O. Bobby, why don't you introduce our guest?
Okay. Our guest is the legendary Ken Scott, one of the five main Beatle engineers, producer of David Bowie, producer of Supertramp, bands you might know like Missing Persons, Devo, Kansas, recorded Elton, recorded the Rolling Stones, recorded Pink Floyd, and there's probably a whole bunch of, well, I know there is a lot of others that I can't think of right now.
So he's just starting out then.
Yes, right.
So he's having to pick up a gig here.
Well, we'd like to welcome Ken. Well,
one of the things, though, that I do want to say that I think kind of puts it all in perspective is I was just doing research for a book that, book of Ken's memoirs that I was lucky enough to help him write. And in doing the research, I wanted to find out how many album sales, record sales that he was involved in. So I started to do the research, and anybody that's ever done that knows it's not quite that easy to get the numbers. But I stopped at 200 million. And that's not $200 million or pounds. That's 200 million unit sales. And believe me, it goes beyond that.
And wow.
That's a lot of records.
Yeah. Well, Ken, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good evening.
How do you even live up to that intro? That
was I'm going home now.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, I had the honor of hearing Ken speak over at the Musicians Institute last Monday, and it was such a fantastic talk, and Ken's done so much. So I'm so glad he's here, because some of the stories we just got to start right now. So Ken, why don't you tell us a little bit of how you got started in audio?
It was a tough road. I knew what I wanted to do very early on, because I was lusting after an English singer called Carol Dean, and happened to see her in the studio on TV one day, and knew that's what I had to do. I had to be the guy behind the glass, controlling everything, and so worked towards that. So eventually got fed up with school, and one Friday evening wrote about 10 letters. I pulled out the phone directory and found as many recording studios, record companies, radio, TV, anyone that might need a recording engineer, and sent out probably about 10 letters, and heard back from one of them on the Tuesday, phoned them up, set up an appointment for the next day, the Wednesday, for an interview. Had a great interview, was shown around the studio, and I heard from on the Friday and left school that day and started the following Monday. So it was just over a week.
And what studio was it?
One that probably no one's ever heard of. It was EMI Recording Studios, which that, when they changed their name, suddenly everyone knew of it. It was Abbey Road.
Not a bad first studio.
No.
So let me ask you a question. When you first sent that letter out, was it like just a shot in the dark, or did you know that they were as big as they were and that they were the...
No, it was just one of the few that I found in the phone book. So, because back then, no one knew what recording engineers were. There was only one producer, really, that anyone knew of, and that was Phil Spector. Even George Martin, he was on his way up. This was sort of two albums in for the Beatles, and... So his name was starting to come up, but the only real record producer was Spector, and so it was great because there wasn't the competition that there is today,
right,
when everyone wants to get into the recording studio. So,
perfect. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your first session that you did
as an engineer or second engineer?
Well, that's true because you started. Tell about how you worked your way up.
Started off in the tape library. Was there for about 6 months, and the reason they start you off at the tape library is so you learn how the studio works. You getting tapes from cutting rooms to editing rooms to remix rooms to studios, the whole thing. You slowly learn what happens in the studio, who the people are. And then finally I got promoted, and the first thing I ever do is a button pusher, which is what we were called then, because all you ever did was hit play, record, rewind, and stop. So my first gig as a button pusher was started on side two of A Hard Day's Night. And then I moved into cutting, mastering these days, and did that for a couple of years. And then as an engineer, the first thing I ever do is Your Mother Should Know, which was a Beatles track off of... I'd never sat behind a board before, and my first session was with the Beatles. It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
Wow. And then what about your first orchestral session that you did?
Three days later, I'm the Walrus.
Wow.
Dropped in the deep end.
Wow.
Nothing we'd heard of, though.
No.
And how was it working back then? I mean, what was the workflow? What was a day like when you went into the studio?
Well, when you're working with the Beatles, it was relatively, you'd get in there. The way the sessions were at Abbey Road were the morning sessions were generally 10 till 1. Then the afternoon was 2:30 to 5:30, and the evening was 7 to 10. And I often wondered why they set it up that way, but it always seemed to correspond with the pub hours. So whether that was for engineers or for the musicians, I don't know. But the Beatles started to change all of that, and so they quite often wouldn't come in till 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, if they in fact came in. And then we'd go till 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. So, and it was just sitting there a lot of the time, listening to them running through or working out the arrangements and everything for their songs.
And you just kept the tape running at that time, right? I mean, it was just...
Yeah, well, we discovered that you only really needed one person in the control room at any given time. So there were three of us that were generally in the control room. There was George Martin, there was John Smith, my second engineer, and myself. Once we realized that they were going to be down in the studio just playing, we just needed the tape rolling, that we only needed one person in the control room at any given time. So sometimes it would be George and I would go and we'd go walkabouts, and sometimes it was John and George. And there was one day when it was me and John were just about to go out, and as we're leaving the doorway, the security guy for the studio came up to us and he said, "Here, go upstairs to the third floor and look out the window by Harry Moss's room." "Why?" "Well, just go ahead and do it." So we go up the stairs and we look out the window and we see across the way there's this lighted window, and we're looking into it, and we suddenly realise there are a few girls in there completely naked working out. And so we thought this is a good thing. I was 21, John was 19, and we didn't get out much. We were in the studio the entire time, so we didn't get too many thrills in there. So we were enjoying it quite a lot. So whenever we took a break, that's where we'd go. We'd go up there, we'd look out. Sometimes we'd get lucky, sometimes we wouldn't. this one time, I suddenly got that strange feeling, the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I turned around, and there was Paul and Ringo. And Paul said, "So this is where you get to every time you disappear." And John and I never went up there again, but Ringo came in the next day with the biggest pair of binoculars. those were the Beatles sessions.
And what was the gear that we were working on? Like, what was the desk like that you were recording?
An old EMI Red desk. It was amazing. Its capabilities are probably more on an iPhone than there were back then on that.
Right.
But look at the records that came out from those boards. It was incredible.
And was that three track?
Four.
Four.
Yeah. We started off as a second engineer. They had two Telefunken four-track machines in separate rooms. Then when they got the Studers, then we started to actually sit in the control room to do sessions. No, Studers were amazing. There was one occasion where I saw one that was going out on a recording probably at some hall, some classical thing, and it fell off the back of the truck. And the maintenance guys were petrified. They took it in. They thought it'd be ruined. They plugged it in, set it up, and not only did everything sort of work straight off, it was still in alignment. They didn't do anything to it. So
just degassed the heads.
It was amazing. It was incredible.
The Swiss.
Yeah.
And what about like your monitors? What were you monitoring? And how did you monitor back then? Was it loud? Was it 85? Did you even, was it several different mono monitors?
It was one speaker.
Yeah.
It was an old Altec speaker.
So 605.
605, thank you. See, I don't know those things. That's why Bobby came in to write the book. But we had two speakers. Excuse me. We had two speakers, one either side of the window, but we'd only ever monitor on one because we're only interested in mono.
Right.
And the stereo was always just an afterthought. And as far as outboard gear, we had Fairchild limiters and we had Altec compressors, and basically that was it.
And what did you think of the Fairchilds and the...
Oh, loved them. But we had nothing to compare them to. And nowadays, when you can compare them to a whole load of things, I still love them. They were still the best.
Yeah, but you should tell them, though, that there were 660s, not 670s.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which are different.
Yeah,
and the Altecs were all modified, too,
oh,
right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Were the Fairchilds modified as
no,
well?
No, they were.
So
they
were okay.
I think they were straight, yeah.
Right.
Well, we had these guys that would pull everything apart before a new gear could come into the studio. These guys in their white coats had to pull everything apart so that if something went wrong, when you've got a huge orchestra, EMI, a lot of their stuff back then was orchestral, big classical sessions. And so they didn't want to take the chance of something going wrong and they couldn't fix it quickly and then having to bring the orchestra back. So they would strip everything apart before they allowed it to be used in the studio so that they knew everything about it. They had spare parts for everything. And if anything went down, they could fix it just like that. And what was it? Oh, yeah, with the Fairchilds. They found this one part that somehow was packed in something that they couldn't pull apart. If they opened it up to find out what was inside this stuff,
it
ruin it. So that was the one piece of equipment that they didn't know everything about. So they couldn't modify it.
That was a trend at one stage. They started putting in this
the goo.
Some resin, yeah.
Epoxy. And
resin, exactly right.
Yeah.
Because they were discrete components and people could rip them off, so they munched them all up.
Yeah.
And what were the characteristics of, like, some of those old Altecs back then? I mean, did they just give you unbelievable punch or
what, the compressors?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know, as I say, we didn't have much to compare
that's
them
true.
To.
That's true.
Yeah. we'd use them for pianos, guitars. We never used them on drums or vocals. Those were always Fairchilds. And the Fairchilds also we'd use on piano sometimes. But we'd use the Altecs on bass as well, yeah.
And would you always use something, or was it a real decision to compress and you'd always start with that?
We probably always used them, thinking about it. Interesting. Even though it was a decision, it was a decision that we always made the same every time. I within the book, I've got some session. I've came across some session layout sheets that we always used to have to fill out, and we've copied them into the book. And it's interesting because in EMI, the engineers weren't allowed to set up sessions. It was the maintenance guys had to put the mics out everywhere, and then the engineer could actually place them. But that's all the engineer could do. And as a second engineer, you didn't. All you did was push buttons. That was it. So I can't remember the point I was getting to with that. But I know, with the sessions sheets. And it's interesting because over the three different sessions that we've got in there, even though they're different styles of sessions, like orchestral through just a band type situation, the mics are always the same. The Fairchild's and the Altecs are always the same. How we had the reverb set up was always the same kind of thing. But so, yeah, our decision, but always the same.
Go ahead.
You know, speaking of the reverb, the Abbey Road reverb I always loved the sound of. And in looking at recording the Beatles and reading that, finally found the secret. And it's they high-passed and low-passed it, 600 on the bottom, 10K on the top. And sure enough, those are kind of magic frequencies on reverb. It really sounds a lot better when you do that.
Well, it stops a lot of rumble, too.
Yeah.
It's on the room on next the way door. In? Or
the way yeah, on out? The way in.
Right, on the send.
Yeah, I think it was on the way in. Now you've got me thinking.
Sometimes they do that because they stop the gold.
It was mostly the chamber.
It was the chamber. We did it on the chamber and we did it on the plates as well. Right. So.
Yes, it was in the way in.
Yeah.
Which makes a difference on electronic reverbs as well. I've played with both the ones that have, you know, internal frequency controls that you can, you know, just match everything up, and when you slap a separate EQ in front of it, and it does sound different.
Very much, yeah.
What about the vocal, like the mics and then the vocal?
47s, Neumann U47s.
With the really cool metal pop screens.
Oh, yeah. You know, they make them. They still make those things.
Oh, really?
Because I was thinking they were so cool, someone should do it, and I actually found that someone was making them, and I can't remember who it was.
That's
amazing. Yeah.
Now, do you think the lack of choice that you had back there actually contributed to the quality of the music?
Absolutely. Since
you didn't have to worry about everything else, you know?
We had to struggle to get effects, to get sounds, especially with a band like the Beatles, who I recently on some website put some, or it was in an interview, I said how I thought the Beatles were the most experimental band ever. And I got all of these comments afterwards. No, they weren't. Pink Floyd did more and others and all that. At the time, they were the most experimental band ever. And it became a joke sometimes. Paul and I would go into the mic closet and he'd say, oh, I like that one. It looks good. Let's try it on something. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with how it sounded. It looked cool, so we should try it. And it was always experimenting. And it was great to learn as an engineer working with them because there wasn't the constraint of, well, I can't try a different mic on that because the orchestra, if it doesn't work, the orchestra is going to go into overtime kind of thing. There were no rules. You could do whatever. And so you got to know what worked and what didn't.
And everybody forgets that they were forming pop sound. I mean, everybody says, oh, there were more people creative afterwards. It's like, no, but listen.
But without them,
they were forming and they were coming up with the way. Even coming in late to the studio, even the whole mindset of being creative. And just like, hello, guys.
They changed everything. They changed everything. I've been very vocal about some of the one of the books out there about the Beatles. And I have this, I'm passionate about the truth about those sessions, sort of as close as you can get it. Our memories are such that we all have problems remembering. They were sessions. We didn't expect to be talking about them 40 to 50 years later. So there are problems with that. But I firmly believe that the Beatles are part of world history now. They are going to be spoken about for centuries. And so we need to get it as as right as we possibly can. And so some people that were around at that point, it doesn't bother them as much as it does me. They disagree with some of the stuff that's written, but they won't come out about it, whereas I did.
That's one of the things, though, that we should mention in the book. If Ken couldn't remember something, and let's face it, it's 40 or 50 years ago, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to remember what you had for lunch, you know, a couple days ago. But we would try really hard to get corroboration on a lot of things. Mm. And we talked to a lot of different people that were there at the same time to find out what they thought as well, and if they remembered it the same way. And many times they did, many times they didn't. But that actually, it made for a better story if they didn't. And because what ends up happening is everybody remembers part of the story, but maybe not the same part.
Right.
We've come to find out.
Different experiences.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about the book so that people who are listening know what...
When does the book come out?
Yeah.
Book comes out on June 6th, which...
Which is?
Happens to be the 40th anniversary of Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, really?
And the 50th anniversary of the first time the Beatles stepped into Abbey Road.
Nice. And so, what's the title of the book?
Abbey Road to Ziggy Stardust.
Right. And we'll talk about the release of that a little bit later, but... Yeah. That way people know when we reference the book, that's the book we're talking about.
Yeah.
Let me ask you...
If I can just jump in with one thing there, just with the stories. There was one that I remembered when I was a second engineer, button pusher, to do with an American singer called Jackie DeShannon. She came over to record at Abbey Road. I was on the session, and there was this thing with Jimmy Page. This was before Zeppelin. He was still a session guitarist at that point. And there was this thing that I remembered about her and Jimmy Page and what went on in the session. Well, I was invited to go see a Beatles film that someone had put together. And I saw on the invites that she was going to be there. So Bobby, you got to come with me. Let's see if we can get her side of the story. So we went down there and spoke with her about it. And she remembered it slightly differently from me. It was, okay, so who's right here? Well, a few months later, I'm in England, and I'm at an event that Jimmy Page is at. And so I spoke to him about it, and he remembered it exactly the same way as I did. And so it was great to get, suddenly it was, her part of it is absolutely correct, but she didn't go quite far enough. And it was great to have that second voice agreeing with what I'd said. So
it's really good you're doing this now. I mean, unfortunately, because nobody's getting younger. Everybody's going to be around.
The way I got into this, the book and my talks, is I was over one of those stupid things that rock musicians get into, spending money hand over fist. I was doing an album with a band called Duran Duran. And... I had to do an acoustic guitar overdub, which I knew would take 15 minutes. Well, Warren, the guitarist, was in London. I was here. And they said, well, where would you like to do it? And I just jokingly said, well, how about number 2, Abbey Road? And they said, okay. So that weekend, I'm flown over there, first class, put up in top hotel there, go into Abbey Road number 2, takes 15 minutes, and we're done. But on that day, maintenance engineer that was on, he came down. He started at Abbey Road just about the same time as I did, a gentleman by the name of Brian Gibson. And he came up and he said, I asked specifically to be on today because I wanted to chat with you. And we were talking. And he said, do you remember when we started that there was all of these old timers that would tell us all of these incredible stories about the starting of the recording industry and all of that? I said, yeah, of course. How can you forget it? He said, well, we've now become them. We're the old timers and the kids want to hear our stories. And it just dawned on me. We've lost those amazing stories first time round. No one was interested in books or videos or anything of their stories. And we can't let it happen again. Technology is moving way too fast, and we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater quite a lot of the time, and so we can't let those stories disappear. We've got to get as much of that as we can so that we don't lose it completely.
Well, and especially with traditional studios going away, you're not in a room with 8 people to tell the stories too. You have to do it in a book or in a movie or in a talk or something like that.
So do you think in 20 or 30 years' time people are going to sit down and ask questions of current producers and say, well, I sat down with my Mac laptop.
No, they'll just say, do you know anyone who worked on the Beatles?
I should hope so.
Well, I'll come in on my Zimmer. And
you know, Ken, why don't you – there's a great story that you told about – the White Album sessions, how they weren't as bleak as they're painted.
Not at all. They were working on the album for close to 6 months. And I don't know about all of you, but I've worked on projects that they've lasted 2 weeks, and someone at some point is going to lose their temper. They're artists. They're creating. So there's going to be some friction there at some point or another. And of course, that occurred over 6 months. It happened more than once. But generally speaking, the sessions were great. I remember having a lot of fun doing them. And I interviewed Chris Thomas, George Martin's assistant, at that point, for his recollections. And at the end, it was the typical interviewer question, last question: is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like to bring up? And I came up with that, and he said, "Yeah, please tell everyone they were fun. We had a blast. They weren't as bad as everyone said. It was every now and again, yes, absolutely. But what if you look at the Let It Be outtakes that are available, you can see even with Let It Be, they were having a lot of fun there. And right. It was, the movie was cut together to make it look a lot worse than it was. But
can you dispel the myth about Yoko, maybe? That she broke up the Beatles.
Yeah, way. It's, Yoko was there, and she was by John's side all the time. It wasn't that bad. She was a little strange at times, but it was fine. John just decided to bring his girlfriend in for the first time, and that Paul brought his girlfriend in. And that didn't happen very often up to that point, but it didn't change it that much.
Were there any sessions that you did back then where you knew at the end of the session that you just heard something magical? You just heard something that was truly, you know, gonna change? Or was it just like, well, that was a Tuesday?
I guess more than anything, that was a Tuesday.
Really?
Working with the Beatles, it could get very boring. And the one thing that kept me going through it was the knowledge that it was going to be amazing when it was finished. But then having worked through it, it never was quite as amazing as I expected. There's the whole thing, like you take Ziggy Stardust, that I keep on hearing the effect that it had on people and all of that. I don't understand it. It's a good album. But 40 years later, still talking about that damn record, it's insanity. It's we made records back then to last for 6 months when the next record would come out. Right. And if people were still talking about it in 6 months, you've done your job properly. But 40 years later, I don't get it. Transformer, the Lou Reed album, there's one good track on it, as far as I'm concerned, but it's a classic album. Whatever.
Well, speaking of which, why don't you tell the Herbie Flowers story about Walking the Wild Side?
We were working out the basic track. The way those sessions went for Transformer, Lou, who was there physically, never there mentally, due to certain substances of which I don't know what they were, but...
Oh, really? They did that?
strangely. He would teach the song to Mick Ronson, Ronno, and then Ronno would teach it to the session musicians. And Ronno was teaching Walk on the Wild Side to them, and the drummer, I can't remember who it was, but he started off with sticks, and it was sounding like a march. It was ridiculous, so I kept dash down. Do you have brushes? Yes. Swapped over to brushes and that kept. And then quickly moved on to Herbie playing upright bass. We laid the track down, and Herbie comes up to me afterwards. He said, can I put down another bass, an electric bass? And I said, hey, David, he wants to put down another, because it was Bowie that was producing. I said, he wants to put another bass on it. Should we try it? And he said, yeah, let's try it. And that's what gave the classic Walk on the Wild Side bass part. But what Herbie later admitted to was that all he was interested in was that if you double track something because of the Musicians Union, you got paid twice. So he actually got paid £24 for that session as opposed to just the 12. Yes. So for that bass part, like less than $50.
Thank God he decided amazing. Not to just double it. That's the thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what we used to do a lot with the Beatles. It would be a 4-string bass doubled with a 6-string Fender bass. And I think they got that from working in Germany with they did some work for a guy called Bert Camford, who his orchestral sessions he always had upright bass doubled with a electric bass, and think that they must have got that idea somehow from that. And several times we doubled. We had two of them playing bass at the same time, one 4-string, one 6-string, and doubling that.
And it must have been a nightmare because today people come and say, oh, I'd like to put another bass track down. You're like, well, I don't have any tracks. I've got a bounce of that one.
They would do it live. They would do it together.
Oh, they do it.
It's
a performance.
Wow. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, really quick, before we take a break, let me ask you one quick question about back then when you were with the Beatles. Did they, were you listening to a lot of other music, like Phil Spector and a lot of stuff that was happening in America at that time? Or were you just myopic and they were just kind of doing their own thing?
Well, they obviously listened to a lot of stuff. Yeah, we were hearing stuff, but the amount of time we were in the studio, we didn't get to hear that much. And radio stations were crap back then in England, so it's you didn't get much chance to hear too much.
But you heard it when you were cutting. Because EMI distributed Motown.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff, like the Motown stuff, got to hear. John Coltrane stuff got to hear, which I didn't like at that point. But of course we got to hear the hits, but there were a lot of American acts that had a lot of they changed things from over here that we didn't get to hear. It was Airplane to start with, wasn't it? Yeah. Jefferson Airplane. I never heard for years. Hendrix, I'm sure I would only have heard because he came to England to become successful. Mm. So there were a lot of American acts that I didn't get to hear.
Mm. Why do you think that it just out of talking about the English and American thing, and maybe I'm being biased, but it always seems that the pop nucleus comes from England. And am I being wrong?
That's my firm belief.
Do you think it's because... I mean, not to generalize, but I think the Brits we had generally a lot less gear, and the gear was more expensive. They did more with less, maybe.
No, I don't think it's that. Yeah. Sorry,
no.
Do you want?
No, I think there's something cultural about yes. it. There is something with English musicians, and the words are going to sound like this is a bad thing. There is no fear of being cheesy.
Right.
So they will be very accessible in a genre that you might not have expected to be accessible.
Well, there's that, but there's also, I think, the English public are much more accepting of new things than they are over here. And you think of recently, the Killers had to go over there to get a record deal. Scissor Sisters still don't mean anything over here, but huge in the rest of the world.
That's also because of how bad the radio is, too, because like Radio 1 would play everything.
Yeah.
Back to back. There is no sense of this is a rock station. This is all the music you should hear.
When I talk at universities, that's one of the things I push, because that's something that scares me. What I'm starting to hear with music now is it's becoming very generic, because the audience is limiting itself to one particular what it likes, the music it likes, and they'll listen to rap all the time, or they'll listen to heavy metal all the time, and they just keep regurgitating the same thing. They're not pulling from outside sources, whereas within England, with the BBC, you'd hear a lot of crap stuff, but then suddenly something would come up. Oh, that's great, but the bad stuff would stick at the back of your head somehow, and at some time or another you could pull some of that in to make it your own music, as opposed to just regurgitating the old stuff you keep on hearing.
You had a great point. Right. There was a point where the Gary Glitters of the world, and there was a whole couple of years of great pop records. When you listen to them, you go, oh, this is... But they really didn't have any shame. They're like, let's have a...
But because I like progressive rock, and you look at Genesis, and all of these amazing bands, Floyd, and they just all came out. They were all from the same era.
Well, and even keep going. You look at New Wave, and look at, there's been a lot of great punk bands and stuff.
You just,
Hey, we're going to take a break right now, and then when we come back, we're going to continue visiting with Ken, and we'll pick it up with Bowie and go through, you know, now.
Okay.
All right, so we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were listening to some amazing stories from Ken. And then, Andrew, you brought up an interesting point. Why don't you go ahead
and elaborate? I just wanted to get the straight story on the earlier records before the White Album, when the band apparently was not that interested in the stereo mixes. Who was doing them? Who was there? Who approved them? Like, what was the process for doing the stereo mixes for those early records?
They were thrown together much after the event. It was... No one in England was particularly interested in stereo at that point.
Because a lot of them were done for the American labels, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's why the stereo was done. Our stereo was, in England at that point, was you'd put a radio in one corner, you'd put the TV in the other corner, and every Saturday morning for an hour, 2 hours, they did demonstrations, and generally it was a train going from left to right, a car going, and part of my talk, I then have the high spot, which is stereo tennis, so you hear the ball bounce, boom, from one side to the other. It was great. That was stereo back then. But we always, even when we would go, with the White Album, which was the first one that they actually got involved in for the stereo, even that, all the recording was done. We were monitoring mono completely. I can't think of any time we monitored in stereo.
Wow.
And they only got involved in the White Album, the stereo, for one reason, and that was they had started to get letters, I believe it was from Japan, but it could have been other places as well, where fans were saying, did you realize that there is a difference between the mono mix and the stereo mix? And this is how it's different. And so suddenly it clicked in. Oh, we can sell twice as many records. So let's make sure that the stereos are different to the mono. And that was the White Album. That's why they got involved in the stereo at that point. And then, of course, then it went to Abbey Road, which 8-track by then. So it was, you could actually start to do decent stereo mixes.
And so up until then, would you just be left to do them and then they'd be shipped off, or?
Oh, yeah, it was George and the engineer would do them.
Right.
And quite often, we didn't take lots of notes or anything like that. So if there was vary speed on something, we wouldn't know what it was.
Right.
We'd just guess at it, and quite often it was different.
Wow. Yeah.
Or just any effects that we used. We had no idea. And
that's wow. Amazing. Well, for anyone who hasn't listened, just we were talking in the break that the box sets came out 4 years ago now, something like that, with the mono box set. This, especially like Rubber Soul, Revolver, things like that, most Americans have never heard the mono versions. It is different. It is different music, different grooves. Everything about it is totally different and well worth listening to.
Well, wow. Absolutely. It's the only way to listen to them. I just wish I had mono copies. Seriously, they didn't bother to send any. I got stereo ones, but no, we didn't make enough and we want to sell them, so we can't give them to you.
I'm going
to
go home and get you mine. That's insane.
No. Yeah.
No.
Well, I'll get you copies.
Well, why you bring that subject up?
I become a grumpy old man on this thing, unfortunately.
What you should realize is that none of the Beatles engineers ever received a gold or platinum record or a diamond record. They never got any credit.
Absolutely nothing.
No.
The re-releases is the first time we ever actually got credits.
Wow.
So.
Yeah.
Wow. Nothing.
Because it was sort of, you were like a technician. It was like sort of like the engine room man.
Well, yeah, yeah. But what gets me, there was originally gold records were for the artist and producer only. So when things happened, I understand that. Well, they were old records. That's not the way we used to do it. But then when you start to put these compilations together, like One.
Right.
It's that then becomes a new record, so maybe it should slightly change then. And what I don't comprehend in the slightest. This is the grumpy old man coming.
Bring it on.
Bring it on.
It's a lot of engineers at Abbey Road received Grammys for the reissues. Hmm. Guess who never heard a thing about the reissue? It was Norman Smith, Jeff Emmerich, Ken Scott, Phil McDonald, and Glyn Johns. We did the original things, but absolutely nothing. So how come Grammys can be given for the reissue of something without the original engineers being given anything?
That's wrong.
Well, this should be the start of getting a bit of a an internet action going, right?
Yeah. Well, it's been tried.
Well, actually, Elliot Schneider took up the cause and actually managed to get the gold records.
Well, get Capitol to agree to give us. Yeah.
But Ken would have to buy them.
Just approved, so you can go to the place in Burbank and they'll make it for you for $80.
So we'll go to Norman Smith's widow. And say, oh, you can have gold records, but you have to pay for them. Yeah, yeah, right.
You should go to Capitol Studios then and nick a cup off the entranceway.
Go to Apple in London. They have the Diamond Awards. They have all of them there. So yeah,
amazing.
That is amazing. Sounds like Kickstarter.com.
Now, were you guys contacted at all about the reissues, about being involved, or they just did them?
Interesting enough, a good friend of mine was in charge of all of that. So I would get – he was doing technical notes. So every now and again, he'd call up and, look, I found this. Does it make sense kind of thing? And he'd ask me something about that. But apart from that, no, nothing.
So other than the parts that make you really bitter about them, what do you think sonically about them?
Oh, I think they're great. I love them, yeah. I know the amount of work that went in, and I don't – every one of the people that worked on those should have won that got the Grammy. Right. I absolutely no ill feeling towards them about it. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Right.
Danny's like, the first time this really came up for me was I was lucky enough to go to the opening night of Love in Vegas. And when it started, the way – what Giles Martin and Paul Hicks had put together, the sound was absolutely phenomenal.
Right.
And I'm sitting there, I've got this huge grin on my face.
Yeah.
And there'd be a sort of down spot in the thing. So I'm going through the program and I'm looking at it and I'm seeing all of these people credited. And once again, it was one of those situations. No Norman Smith, no Jeff Emmerich, no Ken Scott,
tragic.
No Phil McDonald. The pizza delivery guys, they all got credited, but we didn't.
And you know, especially that show, because that's all taken your stuff and
and from the tracks. Yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't re-recorded. It's still your recording.
The whole show is all the original tracks. Yeah. And it sounds phenomenal. That's probably the best sounding venue.
One of my favorite studio things ever was I was working in 2 at Abbey Road, and we had to go into 3 to get something. And that's where they were doing all this. And there's this, is it an 80 input or a 90 input K? And there are 12 faders in the middle of the console that are up, and it's Mr. Kite. You know, but that's it. And the entire console is off except for these few faders right in the middle.
Well, you were actually allowed in there when they were doing that.
They didn't know.
Because that was Project X for a long time.
I know, it was,
time.
Absolutely. Yes, but it was one of these star-studded things, and like, we were allowed to go in and grab some cables.
I was lucky enough to get a behind-the-scenes tour of Love.
Oh, wow.
And when we went downstairs, actually, that it was fabulous because you get to see the prosthetics room and, you know, it was just great. But anyway, we went to the audio room finally. And what they did is they put a supposedly as close to a copy of 3, of the control room of 3, as they could. And everybody wanted to go in. And apparently they got MI5 to come in and put the security around it, and it was, you know, iris identification and everything to get in, fingerprints and all. There was no way you could get in. And I understand when they started the Love show, MI5 again came in with all sorts of jamming technology so people couldn't bring their cell phones in and record anything or take any pictures. Yeah.
Wow.
I knew there was high security. I didn't know it was quite that far.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a fantastic show. That's the Love show over at the Mirage in Las Vegas, which is – I've seen it 3 times and I could see it another 4 times.
They had the – now, this is what they said. It sounds far-fetched to me, but apparently the drive that had all of the Beatles tracks on it, the copies of the tracks – was insured by Lloyd's of London for $1 billion.
Which, of course, is ridiculous since it's just a copy.
I know.
But
it's a good story.
But you realize why it's the $1 billion. It isn't so much that it can be lost or damaged. It's bootleggers. I had to go through this thing. I was blessed to work with George shortly before his passing on reissue of All Things Must Pass and a bunch of other things. And as we were working on All Things Must Pass, I was trying to find all the master tapes and all that kind of thing. And there was one 8-track to 8-track that was missing. And tried to find it and couldn't find it anywhere. So it wasn't something that we specifically needed, unless at some point in time George and I got to do what we wanted to do, which was remix the album and do it without the Spectre reverb and all of that kind of thing, more like Let It Be Naked, that kind of thing. So we didn't need it, so let it slide. I came back to LA and I got a phone call one day from someone I knew and said, guess what's just been put on my desk? And it's that stupid question, oh, I don't know. What the hell could it be? But he went on to describe a tape box. He said, it's an 8-track. It's got an orange label, which was the Trident label. And I said, and it's got these titles on, right? And it was the 6 titles from that we'd lost. And it turns out it was the tape. And someone over here had an English person that had bought Trident after... after its successful years, and he apparently found the tape in the street. It had just been dumped with all of this other stuff.
Oh.
And he found it, and it was very nice. He said, and I've been trying to give it back to its owners. I contacted Apple in New York. Now, Apple has never had an office in New York, so it was obvious that that was a lie. And he said, I just want to give it back to its lawful owners. Now, George had passed by this time, so it would have been Olivia and Danny. And I arranged, next time they were going to be over, I said, have a meeting. You can actually put it in their hands and they can say thank you. He said, that's great. Well, a couple of days before this happened, he calls me up and he said, oh, I've got to cancel. I can't do it this time. Can we set it up for another time? So set it up for the next time they were out here. 2 days before, he cancels. Only this time he takes it before. You know what? It cost me a lot of money to look after this tape all this time.
Oh,
and so it was, if it had got out to the bootleggers, it would have been worth a small fortune.
Yeah.
So had to pay it off. Really? Get it back, yeah.
Ah, that's horrible.
But, yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah.
If he would have told you right up front.
Oh, that's one thing, yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Man. Think somebody would just go, you know, some of these guys deserve this thing back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
Well, let's move forward a little bit. Tell us about when you first started working with David Bowie, because that was a pretty good story that you can tell on that one.
I had done 2 albums with David as an engineer, with Tony Visconti producing. That was the Space Oddity album and Man Who Sold the World. David took a break for a while and came back in producing a friend of his. Now, I don't know how many of you know what hot pants are. The sort of shortest, tightest... shorts for people that don't know, and they were the fad in England for a while. And the way I always describe it is that 90% of the women that used to wear them shouldn't, and the other 10%, it's the drool starts coming down the corner of your mouth. Yeah, absolutely. Well, David came in to produce a friend of his, and this friend was wearing the tightest, shortest hot pants that we'd ever seen in the studio, and unfortunately he shouldn't have been. And so that was one of the things from that session. But the other thing was that during one of the many tea breaks, I happened to say to David that I was interested in moving into production and giving up just engineering. And he said, I've just signed a new management deal, and they want to put me into the studio to record an album so they can then get me a record deal. And I was going to produce it myself, but I don't know that I'm capable of doing it. Will you co-produce it with me? And so the first album I produce is Hunky Dory with David Bowie.
Not a bad start.
Yeah, I'm just blessed. What can I say? If I believed that much in luck, then I'd be in Vegas and I'd be a multimillionaire. That's the way my life has been. And it's just astounding that.
Yes, but go on to Ziggy Stardust.
In what respect? How quickly we did it after? Yeah. Well, we recorded Hunky Dory, and a couple of weeks later, I see David walking down the corridor saying, "We're going to go in and do another album." I said, "You've got to be nuts. Hunky Dory isn't even out yet." And he said, "No, management want me to go in and record another album." And he said, "You're not going to like this one. It's more rock and roll." And he turned out to be wrong about that, but that finished up being Ziggy Stardust. I was just...
That's brilliant.
We went through this thing with the drama, with Woody, that he complained to me, after finishing Hunky Dory, he complained to me that he felt that the drums sounded like he was playing cornflakes packets. And so what we did, the first day of doing Ziggy, I had the second engineer go out and buy all these different size packets of Kellogg's cornflakes and had the roadie set up the drum kit just with Kellogg's cornflakes packets, all the different sizes, and Woody just came in and fell about on the floor. But then we quickly moved the drum kit in and got the drum sound.
The thing, though, that maybe you should tell everybody is about the length of time it took to record most of the albums back then.
Mean 2 weeks? Yeah. Everything. Artists at that point were signing recording contracts where they had to do 2 albums a year, one every 6 months. And so you didn't have that much time. We took 2 weeks to record an album, 2 weeks to mix, and then they'd have a little time off before they started rehearsals to go out on the road, do a tour, then start writing the next album, go in and do it 6 months later. So, no, it was generally 2 weeks.
You know what's amazing is when I was listening to you talk, how when you recorded something, if you didn't like that take, you didn't comp it. You just re-recorded. You just
absolutely
right there, right on top.
Went over the top of it. Now, that was me. I'd got used to – when working with 4-track, you have to make decisions.
Right.
Because you're recording bass, drums, guitar, piano, all together on one track. You learn to make decisions working on 4-track. And I found much the same with takes. It was, you know, the one. You don't need to do 1,000 takes and then go back to take 2 or 3, something like that.
Right.
So it was just go over it. Okay, that's the one. Maybe keep 2 of them. But there were, like, Richard Perry, he would do God knows how many takes on things, and he would keep every single reel. But there was a method to his madness. He had this great memory, and we'd record like 70 takes on a title. And at the end of it, he'd say, "Okay, now I want you to go up and edit it together. I want take 25 for the intro, take 32 for the first verse, then take 15 for the..." And I'd go up and I'd splice them all together. And he was right. It finished up great. There was one occasion when I put it all together and went back down, played it for him, he said, "Yeah, it's really good, except in the second verse you use take 24, not take 25. "You've got to be bloody joking." And he said, "No, go and check." And I went up and he was absolutely right.
Wow.
I was one take off. It was incredible.
Going back to Bowie and the Spiders, though, how many takes a day they do usually?
Oh, we didn't do that. There'd probably be 2, maybe 3 complete takes. With David, with his vocals... The hardest vocalist I've ever had to record, because every song was one take. It was, we'd just get the level at the beginning. He'd sing it from beginning to end, and that was it. That was the one. It was
that's
my
amazing.
Job was so hard.
And
it was terrible.
Rehearsed before the session started.
Sometimes they knew the material, so often they didn't. And that's the thing. There's an excitement to it. They're sitting on the edge of their seat, trying to get through the bloody number. I, for the longest time, have had this thing. I'm not keen on working with session musicians. I like that the musicians have to struggle and play, try and play more than their accomplishments before, kind of thing. Whereas a session musician, oh yeah, you want me to play that? Okay, and just plays it straight off. And somehow it lacks the feel and excitement that you get with someone struggling to get their part.
Wow.
You know, your comfort zone. I've been writing with somebody just recently, and he's a competent player, but he plays other instruments not very well, and we're writing together, and I said, let's get out of your comfort zone. Don't play that. Play this. He's like, well, I don't really play this very well. I said, brilliant, let's do that. Because you find like lots of bands that don't play that well come up with really cool stuff.
Absolutely. Well, look, the Beatles, the classic example. They weren't trained musicians. They did what they did.
Although Germany got them into shape.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Three shows a night, 6 days, six nights a week.
That was brutal.
Try and get a band these days to play three nights on the
three shows. Right. Sorry. Without an edit.
There was a great, well, somewhat great video that was done by the BBC for the 40th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper. They decided to get a bunch of modern bands to re-record Sgt. Pepper in exactly the same way, four-track, or like they used Jeff Emmerich to engineer it and Richard Lush as second engineer. They did it at Mark Knopfler's studio because he had a red desk there. Well, when it was first announced, all of these English bands, yes, I want to do it. Then they suddenly found out there's no auto-tune. They have to play all together.
Yeah.
And they all backed out. A lot of them backed out. But there's this great bit of the video that I will sometimes use in my talk where it's the Kaiser Chiefs, and it's two of them discussing the process. They said, yeah, we did something like 25 takes. We've never done that many before, and we all played together. It was unheard of. We've never, you know what, and we hear the difference. It feels better. Listen to the old-timers. They do know what they're talking about.
So, Ken, I know you have a ton of stories about a lot of the other artists that you've worked with, but let me ask you a question. All the technological changes that you've seen from back from the Beatles up to the stuff you've done today, what are a couple of them that you've thought have really helped us, and what are a couple of them that you thought have kind of hurt us?
That's very easy. The one that's helped us is Pro Tools, and the one that's hurt us is Pro Tools. For me, it's the problem isn't so much the technology, it's us as humans.
Right.
We have to overdo everything. As an example, I remember the first time I ever heard a wah-wah pedal, and I thought, wow, that's cool, it's great, until 2 weeks later it was on every bloody record that was out at that time.
Right.
We have to use everything to death. And the whole thing of, well, digital's in, so we have to get rid of analog. No, analog has a lot of great things about it.
Right.
And why can't we use that and digital and use both of them for what they're both best for? And as I was saying earlier, it's that make decisions. It's the whole thing with plugins now is just absurd. We got a lot of what we did with the Beatles because we had to struggle to get the effects. It helps push it along, kind of thing. Just
right.
it gives it an edge because we're pushing so hard to find things and come up with different things. Now it's so bloody easy. It's
not special,
but it's so easy people don't even do it.
Right. Well,
I will do that later.
Well, yeah,
I don't want to commit to that.
Well, that's why albums these days take like 3 years between albums when it used to be 6 months. And if you think about the songs that were written by these acts within 6 months, like take Elton, he the songs that he came up with, I was lucky enough to see him write Rocket Man, and it took him 5-10 minutes.
Yeah,
it
was, really?
Well, yeah. Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, he wrote every song that morning, pulled out lyrics. All right, during breakfast, wrote the song, the classic albums on that album. No? Classic albums, that's what they said. Let's hear it. Let's hear it.
Well,
excellent.
Well, you see, I was supposed to do that album. And the in place at that time was in Jamaica. The Stones had just recorded at this reggae place. And Elton didn't want to record in France anymore. He wanted to try somewhere new. So Gus Dudgeon, the producer, said, why don't we go to this studio in Jamaica? And we all fly over there. It's great. We're in there. We go into the studio the first day. Now, the first trip to the studio was terrifying because an American union was trying to unionize the studio, and it was a whole record company thing. They manufactured the records there. They had the studio there. It was a complex, and this American union was trying to unionize everyone in that complex, and they were out on strike. So we were going into the studio in this van, there were all of these people along picketing, and they were trying to push the van over, and we were terrified. But we got in there. So the first thing, as always, drum sound. Nigel has his kit set up. I mic it, go in the control room, start to listen, and there was absolutely no depth to the drums, and it didn't matter what I did, I couldn't get it. And Nigel is slowly but surely getting more pissed off because it's just, well, try the low tom, boom, 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 boom. Okay, hi, boom. When are we going to get the bloody drum sound? And I couldn't do it. I said, look, I tell you what, Nigel, let's record a bit. Then you can come in and you can hear the problem that I'm having. We record a bit. He comes in. We play it off the multi-track, and it sounds even worse. Obviously, the tape machine isn't aligned. Okay, get the second, go get a test tape. We put it on, going through high end, we set it up, well, 1K we set it up, then high end we set it up, then we go down to the low end. We hit 100 cycles and all I could hear was tape noise. I could see the meters reading, but absolutely no sound, and that's what it was. There was nothing below 100 cycles on the monitors there, and that I suddenly realized why all the reggae records suddenly had so much low end. It wasn't that they wanted that, it was because they couldn't hear it. But so Elton played a lot of the stuff for me there in the studio.
All right.
And so I know it wasn't written in France.
Just the arrangements then.
Yes.
Yeah, but a little misinformation on that.
But Honky Chateau, though, he was it Honky Chateau where most of the songs were written?
Oh, yeah, right, yes. Yeah. Because it was all to do with English tax law. And that could be why they said about writing the songs in France.
And it was the other album.
No, there was this thing where if the song was written outside of the UK, as long as you left the money from that outside of the UK, you didn't have to pay tax on it. So suddenly all of these artists were recording in France because of that.
Wow.
And they were writing the material there. Well, Elton was.
How does anybody audit that? Like, no, you had that idea. You were well, saying, I knew that.
It's that thing. If you record it there in England and everything, then it becomes...
It's pretty hilarious.
More logical. But it was Bernie Taupin would go up to his room at 8 o'clock every night and come down to breakfast with a bunch of lyrics, hand them over to Elton. He'd be going through them whilst eating breakfast, pick out a couple, go over to the piano, boom, 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 Rocket Man in 10 minutes. Then they'd rehearse it.
Wow.
And we'd sort out the arrangement. That was a great way of making records.
Unbelievable. Let me ask you, as we have to wrap it up, but...
Oh, no.
Believe me.
That's right.
We'll bring you back, especially when does the book come out?
June 6th.
Yep. We'll have to bring you back because there's a lot more to I know you have a lot more stories out there, and but what I wanted to ask was the music industry in general, is there hope? Absolutely.
It's going to flourish again. As far as talent has to win out, it always has done. And it's my big thing is I'm waiting for the complete demise of the majors, because get rid of the attorneys and the accountants that now run the business, and then talent can start doing what it's supposed to do, and that's create. And that's both musically and sonically. I think once the majors are out of the picture, then you'll have artists that won't brick wall everything. They'll feel they can have dynamics in something. And the hardest thing is going to be getting the music out to the masses. How do they find what they like? And to me, it has to go back to the way radio was back in the 60s and 70s, where it's The DJs play what they want to play, and people get to know, oh, I like what that DJ plays. And so you listen to them all the time.
Right.
I was blown away yesterday. I downloaded, illegally, of course, a BBC program. It's called Jarvis Cocker Sunday something. I can't remember. It's Jarvis Cocker was a singer with an English band called Pulp. And he now has his own radio show every Sunday on the BBC. And it's the way it used to be. It's great. He covered... There was something that he played by... it was Quincy Jones with Toots Thielemann on harmonica. It absolutely blew me away. I'd never heard it before, and it was incredible. But he's going through all of these different things. The way he bases this show is what happened on this date. And he went back in 1803 or something like that, the first move to abolish slavery in England occurred. So he did some. He played some stuff from the 60s, some of the more sort of political black recording artists and the kind of thing that they were putting out to the general public at that point. And it was amazing. He went from one thing to another to another. Some of it I hated. Some of it I loved. But that's the way it used to be. You wouldn't like everything. And it was great. That's what we have to move towards, much more personality-driven.
It seemed like I remember listening to Katie Cabey and or I forgot what the one in New York, like there used to be DJ and Toad.
Okay.
And what you did is you listened to DJs because they introduced you to music.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's
it.
You trusted their taste.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes,
yeah,
they go, that's it.
And they go, I found a new band. I want you to hear this.
That was their artistic
impact. And it seems like with the internet, that would be such in some ways an easier thing to do that if somebody got a following and everyone went, I love what this guy's introducing.
Yeah.
And then let that be the conduit.
The one problem is that to set up an internet radio station, it costs far more than an over-the-air radio station because you have to pay – it's, I believe you pay artist, you pay record company, you pay across the board.
You pay the NAB as well.
Okay, yeah. Whereas through the air, all you do is pay for the writers.
But that's changing, actually, finally, in the States. There's legislation actually going through to pay the artists. So
radio stations are going to get even worse than they are now?
It could be, you could say, yeah.
Wow.
But if somebody's finding young bands, that you haven't heard this, I found this band over in...
I was going to say, Rodney Bingenheimer here in town did that for a lot with K-Rock. John Peel in England was amazing for that.
Yeah.
He was one of the few that was allowed to keep on just playing whatever he wanted to play.
Well, I just mixed a record for The Wedding Present, and they are always described as John Peel's favorite, The Wedding Present.
Right. Okay.
His name is forever associated with that band.
Yeah.
Well, the encouraging thing, though, is through technology, you can do DJs on things like playlists and with like Spotify with the apps that come within Spotify now. There's ways to get that DJ playlist type of recommendation.
It's still not not personality driven, and I think that's an important part. You respond to the DJ and the music that they play.
Well, that's like back in the 80s, you know, KROQ,
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Richard Blade.
But there are people, like the fact that Jarvis is doing it, and Bob Dylan has his show, and there are people feeling like they need to do it.
Steve Jones, I believe, who's now back with K-Rock.
Wasn't like Satellite Radio also trying to do that, where they're trying to get...
Nikki Sixx is a tastemaker in that realm of music.
Yeah. The biggest problem is, though, because of the internet and everything, everybody's got a voice.
Yes.
So it's millions
difficult.
Of streams. It's like, oh,
yeah. Yeah.
And, you know...
That's how the next fortune is going to be made. It's whoever breaks through.
Yeah. 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 That's true.
But the music is there, I think, now. Now I was at South by Southwest a couple of weeks ago, and the number of bands who were great and into what they were doing and couldn't care less what you thought was incredible.
Oh, wow. Good. Good.
Really, really great.
Wow. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I mean,
me.
I get a round of applause.
Thank you. Awesome. That was a standing ovation for everyone.
And Bobby, thank you so much for working with Ken to bring his story out. I'm looking forward to the book.
You got
to
give Bobby a hand.
Well, you'll enjoy it.
And we're going to have to bring you guys back on. Well, Bobby, you're here, but we're going to have to bring you back on, Ken, when the book comes out.
Yes,
please. Really quick, before we wrap everything up, I have to mention once again that this is the 6-year anniversary of our podcast. And, the podcast started basically over at NAMM shows with me and Rob. We used to get together I would never see him except once a year over at the NAMM show when we get together and have these dinners and talk about gear. And, you know, I thought, hey, I'd make a good podcast, and thought we were going to do it for, you know, a couple times, and, you know, 118 shows later,
yeah,
we're still kicking. But I also have to thank the sponsors that we've had these last 6 years. We, you know, with Aphex, when we first started, you know, Marvin Caesar did it, you know, really helped us out a lot when we first started. And now API, you know, we've got to thank API because they sponsored the podcast now. And, you know, it really makes it possible for this to be free and for us to continue to do this. So we have to give our sponsors and our old sponsors a round of applause. Thank you. And then also we need to thank the listeners. There's a lot of great listeners, and I know you guys, some of you guys have been there from the beginning, and we're now up to 9 listeners.
So. Oh my God.
And, you know, you guys are great, and you send some really good feedback, and you send me some really good emails. And even though I can't respond to all of them, because, you know, 9 is way too many, you know, we read them all. And just so you know, this whole podcast with Ken basically was started by a listener. His name was Joe Marsh.
Joe.
He was the one who said, hey, get Ken Scott on. And I read on.
Thank
and go,
you, Joe.
Yes, why can't
I'll pay
I
pay you later. Scott
on? So Joe, thank you very much. And last but not least, I want to thank all you guys around the table. You guys, you know, some of you have been here since the beginning. Some of you are brand new friends, but you keep showing up. I don't know why, but it's been awesome, and it's been really great to hear everybody's stories and all your different expertise, and I appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners do. So, on that note, anybody working on anything that they want to talk about?
Not after that conversation. I don't think we tell any other stories tonight. Hard ones to beat.
Oh, but you know what? We got to congratulate Andrew on his Grammy.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
First
time.
Yeah.
Thank you. Make sure you get the second red carpet.
Yes, I did walk the red carpet.
Did you walk the red carpet?
I did.
We saw you on TV.
The entire time through the red carpet, I was told, move along, keep moving, please. Move along. You can't take pictures here. Why are you stopping? Please move along. So it was an incredible experience.
I'll tell you what, though. It was awesome when she won, which is Adele, by the way. And I saw you walk up there, man. That was awesome.
Two very quick things about that. So I was sitting pretty far back on the floor. So as soon as the came out of their mouth, I'm like, okay, I better get going. And I started moving, and I got about halfway up there, and there's nobody up there with her. Uh-huh. And I'm, okay, I guess I'll go sit down now. And then two other people went up, like, okay, and then basically had to run. And then we're all standing in this bizarre line about, I don't know, 3 feet behind or something. Yeah. There are no monitors on that stage. So all I heard was some reverb of her voice bouncing off the back of the Staples Center. And then the crowd would laugh, and we'd all look at each other and kind of smile a bit. So it was incredibly surreal. But it was very, very cool.
Well, just know that there was people out there going, woo!
Yes.
I know that guy! Yeah.
Very, very cool. A lot of fun.
And your tux fit very well.
That's right.
Yes. I know. Thanks. If I had the guy's name on the tip of my tongue, I would say, you got to go to this tailor, because he's the man who got me in that tux.
And how late were you up that night? I mean,
well, it's not that late because it's live to the East Coast.
Right. Yeah.
So
true.
It's over at 8 o'clock. So, I mean, we were home by 12:30 or something like that. It wasn't that late.
I think you'd be like Blotto, wouldn't you?
So you're just partying. Yeah.
I thought you'd be hopping all over town, you know?
No. Engineers, we know. You don't get invited to any of the parties.
You get to go set up the next session.
Yeah, exactly.
Go back and do an edit.
Yeah. No, but it was a lot of fun.
Well,
it was really good.
Congratulations.
Thank you very
well done.
Much.
You deserve it, but
you should bring in the Grammy one of these days.
When it takes months. I don't have it yet. I'll bring it in.
All right. Well, anybody else have anything? Anything you want to plug? Anything you want to talk about?
I don't think we want to follow that.
Yeah, that's right. Why I feel.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you on that one.
Yeah. All right. I think we've been here about 4 hours already.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
We only got like 37 minutes on tape, though.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, once again, thank you, Ken. Thank you, Bobby. And for myself and all the guys, thank you for listening. And we'll catch you next time.
All right. Well,
we'll be right back.
Audio Nowcast, sponsored by API and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez and uses AFEX's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.